This time it's about people who make the music happen, or at least a person who makes the music happen. Coming up this hour, we'll be talking about a new book called All Excess, not to be confused with All Access, which of course is a concert term. All Excess, Occupation Concert Promoter is the book, and Danny Zalesko is the author. Danny is a legendary concert producer, promoter, and we're going to be talking with him about the changing face of concerts over the last several decades. Remember the days you used to stand in line and you get good tickets? Well, those days are gone. And so is most of the independent concert promoters. Or are they? We'll find out by talking to one of the legends of the business, Mr. Danny Zalesko. He's coming up momentarily, but right now, let's take a little trip to a rock show, courtesy of Paul McCartney.
Hey!
Ain't nothing like a good rock show. Sir Paul kicking us off here on Midwest Beat. I'm Tom Lounges, and today is a show I'm very excited about because it's a topic near and dear to my heart. As most of you know, I do a lot of regional concert promoting at different theaters and festivals and things, and I get to tip my hat to one of the great masters of the business. Danny Zalesko is one of those. He's got a brand new book, All Excess, which is a takeoff, of course, of the All Access Pass, All Access Occupation Concert Promoter. And a lot of people think that putting on a concert is just an easy thing. What do? You call up the band, say, hey, guys, you want to play a show? Okay, print some tickets and you're in business. Guess what? It doesn't work that way. And we're going to find out the inner workings, the behind the scenes, and the evolution of concert promoting from the days of Alan Freed and the Moondog Matinee Shows of Cleveland. All right, spit it out there, Lounges. Get your act together. Let's see if we got Danny on the phone.
I'm here.
Hey, Danny, thank you so much for being on the show today. Pardon me tripping over my tongue. I'm just very excited about this show. I feel like it's a masterclass for me. I've been doing concert promoting locally for a while, and when I heard the opportunity to have you on the show and talk about your book and read through this book, it's pretty fascinating and easy read. 300 and some pages, lots and lots of great photos from behind the scenes, and now you to tell us some of those stories firsthand. Welcome.
Hey, great to be here, man.
Now, you're calling in from Hawaii, is that correct?
I'm in Hana, Maui right now, facing the mainland, so I can see you from here.
Oh, excellent. I'll tell you, that must be a great place. Are you working or playing right now?
It's a beautiful morning over here. Many years ago, I was invited in on a timeshare from Shep Gordon, who manages Alice Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I and a couple of his buddies bought this place over here in Hana, and we come here 4 or 5 times a year, I mean, just to chill out and recharge.
Excellent. Now, this has been a rough year for concerts in general, concert promoters, bands, everyone's been put to the sidelines due to COVID. Are you getting back on track at this point?
Well, you know, we're still doing the exact same thing we've been doing for pretty much the last exact 12 months, this week, actually. 12 months ago, we were told no more shows, and that remains, as of now, what's going on. You know, we're looking month by month, and we peel off a month on the calendar at a time. I feel like a guy in jail. Isn't that what they do in jail?
Yep.
You know, X off the date. So right now, we're looking at moving our June shows. We're waiting as long as we can with the hopes that this stuff, you know, all the efforts that are going on are going to correct themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Not by themselves, of course, with a lot of work and a lot of cooperation on a lot of people's parts. But, you know, it's like you need 2 to 3 months ahead of time for preparation for a group who's been sidelined, as you say, for all this time, or the halls, you know, the actual venues.
Right.
They need reopen and clean up and rehire staff because they have to lay everybody off. You can't be paying people when you can't book shows. So, I mean, it's a domino effect that's affected so many thousands and thousands of people in our business. So, you know, we have the same crystal ball that you do, and what I'm seeing is a lot of people making an effort to get this behind us, and once it's there, it'll stay there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that we'll ever see anything like this again in our lifetime, thank God.
Hopefully.
But, you know, but I would say this summer we'll be back to enjoying some of our favorite shows, and certainly by the fall, you know, it would appear that that we'll be able to take part in all those shows that we scheduled last year that we've been moving every couple months, which, believe me, is the worst. Calendar hopscotch is the worst game I've ever played.
Wow. Yeah, I'll tell you, it's rough.
Yeah, it really is. So, you know, I've been working on this book for many years, just collecting things and putting things over here to the side. And, yeah, that would have to be in there, and writing down little things when stories would occur to me. And finally got it written. And all of a sudden, I had open time, and I had some people in my office. What am I going to do? So we turned into book writers and book publishers, and now book sender-outers.
And interviewees.
Yeah, lots of interviews. White Castle, God bless them. They gave me a couple thousand of these clutch cases because it fits the book perfectly, not on purpose, by magic. And so people, I swear to God, people have had these books delivered to them, and some unsuspecting person on the other end gets the book, and they go, oh, it's food from somewhere.
Right.
And they throw it in the freezer.
Well, I had that come to me. I got one in a White Castle box, and my wife goes, did you order food? I'm like, no, what's this all about? I looked at the tag. I saw it was from Chip, and I'm like, I know what this is. I thought it was his creative packaging on a tight budget. But that's a very cool way to deliver.
Yeah, and I love those guys. They're great.
So this book was in the works prior to COVID. When did it actually, when did you finish the writing of it? When did it go to the publisher?
Well, it was, we did it locally, because I didn't really try hard to find a publisher or somebody else to put it out, but it had been out there for a while that I was doing this, and nobody bit, so we ended up doing it ourselves locally. We found a guy in Phoenix, a madman who had actually put this thing together for us, and I think he did a beautiful job. But I started writing. I just found an email from 10 years ago that had 20 of the bullet points for chapters that are in there.
Wow.
So it's been something that's been going on for a long time, and thousands of shows and a few decades in the middle of it. There were certain stories and certain people and things that I've told again and again and a few times. So I had some practice at telling a few of the stories in there over the years because they're so good. I mean, telling people that I avoided getting beat up by Mike Tyson is one of my favorite stories, you know. And just because he wouldn't get off Whitney Houston stage. It was one of the funniest nights ever, but I was scared. You know, you get that feeling like when you get caught doing something wrong and you start sweating underneath your clothes. I mean, it happens every now and then in your life. Well, that's what it's like when Mike Tyson looks at you.
Wow. I remember a similar experience, although I wasn't fearing physically. I was fearing being embarrassed on stage. I was emceeing for Chuck Berry, and I know you've worked with Chuck over the years. And he was notorious for not being all that nice. And notorious for not liking MCs. He just wanted to go up. He pulled up in his car, grabbed his guitar out of the back, and went on stage with it, whatever his pickup band was. Well, I was stalling because he was late. And I'm up there, and I'm telling these stories, and I'm talking about Chuck's history. And the audience, suddenly, you could tell the change. And I'm like, oh, what's happening? So I turn around, and here's Chuck walking up the gangplank to the stage. And he's looking at me with steel-cold eyes. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know, it's Chuck Berry. And I walk up to him, I'm like, welcome, Mr. Berry. And he looked at me, he goes, young man, he goes, nice introduction. Now get the F off my stage. And he like, and I'm like, okay. You know, it's like, yes, sir. Thanks for not slapping me or something. But it was funny because, you know, I was told, well, you know, Chuck doesn't want any MCs. Chuck doesn't this, Chuck doesn't that. And the station I was working for insisted I do it. So it was one of those stuck in the middle kind of things. But I was just, it was a thrill to be on the same stage with him. But who was, I don't want to really put you on the spot too much, but who were some of the less favorite artists, shall we say, to work with? Can you say that? I mean, there's some mentions in the book, but Is there anything you want to share on air as far as some of the more difficult acts?
You know, I really went out of my way to not make, you know, the stories about anything bad that happened. Because frankly, I don't remember too many of the bad things. Somehow, it's like a trauma in your life when you're young.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow you put them out of your mind forever. You know, nights with James Brown were always a treat. You know, the Motley Crue shows, the Guns N' Roses shows, those are always, you know, you always knew you were going to have your hands full.
Right.
All kinds of things, just they just come up because you have these crazy characters, you know, around you. And, you know, that music that comes out that we love so much and it's so exceptional and so good, it comes out of crazy people's minds.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that in the most endearing, you know, respectful way, that these characters were gifted with the ability to do things that we can't do, and that makes them really special. Now, how these people handle that special is another story sometimes. But for the most part, you know, along the way, everybody's been fantastic. You know, I've been asked a couple times about difficult artists before. I mean, I guess the one that always stuck out in my mind was when John Mellencamp was mad because he didn't like the nightclub stage that I put him on in Tucson. This is when he first came out and he was still called Johnny Cougar.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And he had a reputation already from the very beginning as being
difficult.
Somewhat difficult,
yeah.
A real personality.
Right.
You know, it's like when you're dating a girl, she's got a nice personality. He's got a great personality. So he came in and he was as nice as could be to me. We did one show. Then we went down to Tucson. We did another show on the stage. I admit was weird, but a lot of great people played on that stage before him. Al DiMeola, The Tubes, Johnny Winter, Muddy Waters. And here's Johnny Cougar for $1.93. And after the first song, he says, "This is the worst stage I've ever been on. I've played on card tables bigger than this. The sound system in my car is better than this."
Wow.
He goes, "You should go." And he points at me. I'm 10 feet away. "Go get your money back from this loser." Right?
Wow.
Yeah. So this is, you know, about what year would this be? About 1982?
Yeah.
81?
Yeah.
80, somewhere. It was a long time ago. And I had, fortunately, there was a couple of security guys that worked for me right there, a couple of big guys. And I started running towards the stage so I could dismantle him. And they stopped me, of course, from going up there. And later on, I was taunted about it, which, you know, it was like, "Hey, look, if you don't like the room you're in, like, get more popular, and I'll put you in a real hall with a real stage and real sound and light."
Right.
But in the meantime, this is the ritual. You're selling tickets for $1.93, and you sold 280 seats out of 400. You didn't even sell out at $2 a head. So quit yelling at me about my gear.
Yeah, we all have those incredible stories like that, and it's a shame. One of the things that, and I don't know what your connection to Chicago is, but you have a lot of great pictures with Mr. Cub, Ernie Banks, and of course you did shows with one of our true legends, Mr. John Prine, and we're going to play a song from him in a minute. But what is the Chicago connection you have? Because clearly there is a strong bond with you and our city here.
I was born in, well, I was actually born at Resurrection Hospital, and I lived around Milwaukee and Oakton until I was 17, which was, I got out of high school in 72, and I went to Our Lady of Ransom Parochial School and Main East High School. So I grew up there, and I couldn't wait to leave. I hated the weather. I hated the ice. I hated the snow. Above everything, I hated shoveling.
Mm-hmm.
And it blew my back. I mean, it's just one of those things. I hated enough so that when I got out of high school at 17, I'd already visited Arizona on a spring break trip. and I saw this theater called the Celebrity Theater. There, 2,500 seats in the round, kind of like the Mill Run,
okay,
years ago. And that's one of the places that I use to this day on a regular basis, like what I would call one of my home facilities. And I saw this place, and I saw that weather in March, you know, for spring break, and it was 85 degrees out, and we're up on Camelback Mountain. I'm going, this is for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved there, and I didn't really realize I was going to start doing shows as a career at that point. But I started booking shows one by one. I starved for a few years, and one thing led to another, one foot after another. And we ran, dominated, and booked everything in the Southwest during the 80s and 90s into the 2000s. So Chicago, growing up, I was lucky enough to be there when Ernie Banks was a young guy. And Brian Piccolo came up on the Bears, mm-hmm, as a young guy, all in the same time period. The 1960s was a great time anyway. But to be growing up in Chicago and having guys like this around, I mean, they didn't set out to be my role models, but they became those guys. And they were a terrific influence on me, and we became friendly. And it wasn't like they were these big superstars anymore. They were our friends.
Mm-hmm.
And they stayed friends all the way to the very end, and never forget them. I mean, those guys are Chicago to me, and I never thank them enough, and I miss them every day.
Yeah, there's some great pictures. I love the one from 1977 where you guys are on the field and you're doing a fist pump, and Ernie's got a big old grin on his face. I grew up in the same era. I was class of 77, born 1959. So I was in Chicago the same time you were, and I agree, it was a great time and a great place to grow up. And as I mentioned, John Prine, I've had Bunny Kolak here on the show in the studio. I've booked her a few times, and she's shared some great stories of Steve Goodman and John Prine, who, sadly, I never got to work with, but you did. And we just lost John to COVID this year, and it impacted so many of us here in Chicagoland. Great pictures in the book of you with the Prines early on and even later towards the end of his life. Tell me about John Prine and working with him.
We had a very special, great bond that was started by his manager called Al Bonetta. Al was from New Jersey, moved to L.A., and he booked John and Steve Goodman, who he managed at the same time. We booked those together at a show that I had in 77 out in Phoenix, and that started this great love affair that we had for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. All three of my guys are gone now. I didn't know Steve had leukemia. And I'd known him for 4 or 5 years before I found out that he came out of remission. He got sick again, so he died in 84. In the meantime, John and I became great friends and started doing a lot of shows together. In fact, out of all the people that I've done shows with over the years, I've done over 200 Prine shows, which makes him my leading scorer.
Wow.
He and I did more shows and barnstormed, I mean, Iowa and Wisconsin and Indiana and Southern Illinois and all over Nashville, Knoxville, all these cities in the 80s. And we went out with our opening acts were Otto Guthrie and Bonnie Raitt.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them, I love them both. They're both fantastic, legendary in their own right. And each time they said, I should probably close a show once in a while here. It's equal billing, you know. We're making equal money. I said, you want to follow John, you go right ahead. He doesn't mind. He likes being done early. And each of them followed him one time.
Wow.
That was it. Yeah, because it's like when John does a show, I mean, people came to visit him. It was like hanging out with your brother or your dad or your best friend. I mean, but it was a great visit for a couple of hours. He had this unique way of as a wordsmith and how to say certain things that in kind of goofy Americana corny sort of ways, but always spot on.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way where when you hear him sing it, you go, I could have written that myself. Why didn't I do that? You
right.
know, because it's all this stuff that's sitting there right in front of you for anybody to grasp and to understand. And one of the greatest writers and funniest people that I've ever had the distinct pleasure of being with. And the fact that, you know, he was taken from us too early is really a crime.
Right. He had a rough go of it the last few years, and then recovering and then going, you know, into remission and then ending it again with COVID was just, it's like after winning all the hard battles, then COVID comes along, you know. Rough.
We had a great Christmas with him in Nashville just before all that happened. So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I miss him terribly, but I'm kind of glad that we got to have, you know, some closure there on that. And not that we needed any.
Right.
But it was great. What a great guy.
We're going to take the listeners back for just a few minutes here from 1971 off the debut John Prine album, and the song that he is probably best known for. Not necessarily one of his greatest songs, but it's his most popular. He has written some incredible songs that we'll get to at a different time. But this is Angel from Montgomery. Give you a little taste of it from the late, great John Prine, a postman out of Maywood, Illinois, who did us proud. Angel from Montgomery, giving you a little taste there of one of his most famous songs, a guy who used to deliver our mail and went on to deliver the goods for so many music fans. John Prine, lost to us due to COVID this past year. And speaking today with Danny Zalesko, who is a concert promoter extraordinaire, has been decades in the business, and John Prine was one of his primary, no pun intended, primary.
He would have liked that.
He was a wordsmith. Yes, he was.
He would have
clients.
Why didn't I use that? That was great.
One of the things that drove me into the music business, on the side that you're on a much smaller scale, mm-hmm. I was booking clubs, and we were doing early dates with like Iron Maiden and Girls School, and Survivor was our house band at our club, and you mm-hmm. know, Humble Pie, Stevie Marriott, and those guys played there, Joe Perry, but they were all just kind of rebooting their careers a lot. And one of the guys that I always looked to for inspiration, never had the chance to meet, talk to, or anything, but I idolized him, and that was a guy who mentored you, Mr. Graham. Bill Graham was the concert promoter of all time, in my opinion, also lost to us much too early, you know, here in the Midwest on that helicopter plane crash with Stevie Ray. But you got to work with Bill Graham. What kind of nuggets of knowledge did that legend, that great man, impart on you?
You know, when from a distance, you know, being in Chicago in the late 60s and early 70s, looking at San Francisco and at New York. I mean, those, Bill Graham was the only thing I really knew about those cities besides the San Francisco Giants and the Yankees and the Mets, being a sports fan.
Mm-hmm.
So growing up in the 60s, I mean, I could only dream of what New York City and San Francisco looked like. And as you recall, I mean, everybody thought about the West when you're living in the Midwest. In the mid-60s, it was all about going to California. It was mm-hmm. all about the Beach Boys, California Girl.
Right.
San Francisco and the Summer of Love. And
putting flowers in your hair with Scott McKenzie.
Scott McKenzie.
Yep.
You know, and it was a buildup. I mean, you could feel the momentum in the music taking shape and building with every new record. Arthur Lee and Love came out and changed so much. And all this was going on right under our noses, and we weren't sitting there buried with our noses in a phone. You know, we were buying vinyl, we were going to concerts, we were hanging out with each other, and listening to some really, really incredible music during those days. And and it turns out that Bill was the ringmaster for it all. And remember back then about going to concerts, it wasn't something that everybody did the way they do now. Like, oh, are you going to that Eagles show? You know, it wasn't like that back then. It was a new business that you know, was developed on the go. Nobody knew about putting on concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill developed that, what became the style that everybody follows to this day, complete with writing down lists of things so that you don't forget them, and advertising and how to advertise, and ticketing and how to do the ticketing, which hall to play a show in, how much to charge for tickets, when to argue tickets are too high, when to argue you should be charging more. All this stuff that he developed without us really knowing it, you know, and his idea was, if you're going to pay a ticket to come to one of my events, it should all be there ready for you. That's what you're paying for. You're not paying to come to work. You're coming to take it easy and get some load off your mind and go to a show.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love that whole concept and that whole idea. It reached me as a kid, and although I didn't know that we would end up becoming friends or working together one day, one could only hope, I guess. And the only way you find out is by going there and somehow finding yourself in his space. And if he's the cool guy that you think he is, and he turned out to be, maybe you get to do something with him. Maybe you get to be friends. And we got to be so much more than that after all those years. And the last 4 or 5 years we had were great together. And although I knew him for many years prior to that, the last ones were the greatest. And by the way, it wasn't he went the same way that Steve Ray Vaughan did, but he wasn't with them.
Right, right.
Right.
The...
That was after a Huey Lewis show.
Okay.
He went to see Huey Lewis, and he went home in his helicopter in the rain. It didn't work.
Jeez.
Very sad.
Bill Graham and Winterland created some of the most incredible live concerts as well. I mean, live albums as well through the different Fillmores. Have any of your shows been immortalized that you know of as far as concert albums, vinyl?
I know there was a live Deep Purple album that I had some sides on. George Lopez concerts were filmed that we did in Phoenix. Also, one of my favorites is when in 1990 we did Paul McCartney, who you were playing at the beginning of our interview.
Mm-hmm.
I love that song, by the way. You don't hear it enough. That's
right.
A great song. Promoters sometimes like to hand out swag to the bands, you know, so that they remember that they visited us. And for those of you who have heard the word swag but never knew what it meant, it's called stuff we all get, okay? So I handed out my swag to Paul, which were like baseball jerseys with some nice stripes on them. And right on the wrist, I had my logo for my company, Evening Star, beautifully embroidered in there. Paul had that show taped, and it was on TV, and he wore that shirt the whole show. I love that one. And it shows Evening Star on his left wrist about 100 times in the video.
That's advertising you can't pay for. Great stuff.
Boy, oh boy. Well, no, he let me pay him for it, believe me. But it wasn't for advertising.
Working on this book.
Paul's a great guy, but he's a great guy, but he doesn't go anywhere for free.
Right. Right. I had the chance to sit in on a press conference with him, and I found him to be the most amazing person, just so cordial and so polite and so kind and so grateful. Even all those years later, this was when he was doing the stadium tours and things with Wings. And even though he was a superstar already, he was still very grateful and very humble. And I always walked away with that notion of him in my head. And I can't say that about everyone I've met, but Paul was one of the good guys.
You know, he kind of is able, because of who he is and how he set the table for so many to follow him. It's like he has a regal kind of royalness about him where he can afford, when he's around you, to make you believe you're the only one that matters.
Right.
And it's a special thing that really special people can do. There's so many, you know, you're right about them. And they don't mean not to be as cool as him. They want to be him.
Yeah, that's true. Don't we all want to be Paul at some point?
I certainly have before. I mean, you know, I was confirmed. You know, and when you get to be confirmed, you get to pick a name.
Right.
And I picked George, and my dad said it better not be because of those Beatles.
Ooh.
It's the Dragons player, Dad. Don't worry about it.
George Harrison was my first concert, 1974, the only time he toured America without the Beatles, and it was at the Chicago Stadium.
Yep.
Were you there by chance?
I saw that show, and I also, I was his dressing room attendant down in Tucson. I was working for Bill Graham, who was putting on the tour, and that was my assignment, was to put up the tapestries and the incense and the lava lamps and the lighting and the little amenities in his dressing room. Then I had to go out and buy him vinegar to gargle with.
Okay.
Because his voice was shot for that tour because he'd never really sung live like that before. And he blew it out the first show, unfortunately. And he had a hard time that tour with his vocals, but the shows were fantastic.
And
it was so much fun to be around him.
I just remember that the crowd was getting antsy because Ravi Shankar and family played like an hour. And it's like, okay, we are respectfully listening, but when's George coming back? Tom Scott and the LA Express was there, Billy Preston. What a great lineup that was.
You know, when you're doing those shows with those genius kind of guys like that, I found it better over the years to not be disappointed by wanting to see what, you know, is ultimately going to happen. But, you know, it's like so hard as a concert goer and a promoter to like suck it up and sit down and go, I'm going to watch this whole thing. I want to see what this guy's doing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great show he did there. I remember being a little fidgety, too.
That was something else. I'm so glad I went because, you know, we never knew that George was never going to tour America again. And that was a one-of-a-kind lifetime experience. So
I always hoped that they would have done a Wilburys tour. That's what I wanted.
Yeah.
You know, it's too bad they couldn't just get it together to at least do a few, you know, go around the world and pick your six spots and film them and, you know, vocal stuff where everybody's from, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I would have loved to have seen that.
Yeah, that would have been great. I'm going to play a short clip here, and I'm going to ask you about it. So stay with me. This is Midwest Beat on Lakeshore Public Radio, and we're talking about the book All Excess. Concert promoter Danny Zalisco is my guest, and this next song has a connection to him. We're going to talk about it.
Troubled past, and I might stop. with one more look at you, I might overcome the anger that I've learned to know. Find a peace of mind I lost so long ago. Your gentle touch has made me strong again, and I'll be loved again. For when you look at me, I'm everything and more than I had dreamed I'd be.
It was the mid-70s, and one of the hottest movies on the screens was A Star Is Born. Kris Kristofferson, Barbra Streisand, Watch Closely Now. That's Babs singing it toward the end of the film. And my guest, Danny Zalesko, was involved in that iconic film. And you were working in a waterbed store, according to your book, at the time. Got a phone call from Bill Graham, and the movie was happening, the tour was happening. Pick it up from there.
Well, what had happened was Barbara had was classically known for having stage fright, and they had, for this movie, Star Is Born, they wanted to update the Judy Garland version and make it a rock theme piece rather than, you know, her typical M.O.R. stance that she's known for so well. So they hired Bill Graham to put on a rock show where they could film Chris and Barbara at their height of their fame in their movie roles and have a rock show setting, you know, behind them and everything. So there is a show that was booked. Bill had Graham Central Station, Santana and Montrose.
Oh.
And he calls me up. I'm in the waterbed store, and he goes, all right. So he goes, so here it is. ZZ Top, Johnny and Edgar Winter, or Peter Frampton? Who headlines? And I took Peter Frampton without blinking. And I said, Bill, it was recorded at Winterland. Frampton comes alive. You got to go with your hometown boy. And on top of that, he was just ready to happen when that happened. The album was already out. It was already starting, but it wasn't there quite yet. By the time March came around of 76, so what is it? That's 45 years ago this week.
Yeah.
It was March 26th. Anyway, we had that show, and Frampton did it, and he murdered it. I was going to tell you, while I'm here in Maui, Chris Kristofferson and his wife live down the street from us here. And we went over last night for tacos, It was that she makes the best tacos on the planet. And we talked about a funny thing that happened about 15 years ago. It turned out that Chris was booked at the Celebrity Theater the same night Barbara was booked at the basketball arena. And they hadn't seen each other since the filming wrapped on that movie in 1975. Or 76, I should say. So he came over to the show after our show, and I was involved in the Barbara show, too. We hooked this all up. And one minute he was standing next to me, and the next minute him and Barbara are standing at the very top of the stage, and she's going, for the first time in 40 years, here's John Norman Howard. And the place just went to bits.
Wow.
It was like, and they had the video screens and everything. To see the two of them together like that, it was just one of the great concert moments ever.
Did anyone record that?
I'm sure Barbara has it. Because the whole thing was on video, and then we all got to, we all hung out with her after the show for a while. It was just great. She was amazing.
You've even got one of the props from the film, the John Norman Howard Speedway with Mars backstage passes in here as well. Brian Wexler Productions is on that. Is that a tip of the hat to Jerry Wexler?
It probably is, but in the movie, I think there's a guy who played Brian Wexler who's just in there for a brief second. He's wearing a hat and he's got long black hair, and I don't know who that is, but I've seen him before. But Gary Busey was his road manager, if you remember.
Yes, yes. Wow. That was when I
How
saw
about that?
When
I know road man. I know road managers like Gary Busey.
When I saw your involvement in A Star Is Born, it's like, we have to touch on that. That was just such an iconic film for our generation. And I don't know. I still, it's my favorite. I mean, I tip of the hat to Judy Garland. And, of course, you know, Lady Gaga did a decent job on whatever her interpretation was.
She was fantastic. But
this one is the one that's mine.
Without what they did was they did the American Idol move on it. They made it their own movie.
Right.
Barbara and Chris. I mean, you don't recognize that movie from one to the other. But with the Lady Gaga thing, I mean, where else were they going to go? It's pretty much the same flick.
Yeah.
Except they made it a country guy instead, which I don't think it works as well. But they did a great job, and it did fantastic. So good for them.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk.
I love that song, that Watch Closely. Now, I remember when he was practicing that backstage at the stadium when that show was happening. I love that song, Watch Closely Now.
I do,
too. That
was
one that he wrote. Yeah, he wrote that within the movie and sang that solo. That song gives me chills.
We couldn't find a good version. We were going to do the Chris version. Well, even the Barbara one was a little tinny, but I didn't have the soundtrack here at the station, and I thought, I got to include this. So we did what we could and played Barb's version. But, yeah, Chris's take on that song definitely rocks.
Yeah, he's great.
One of the things
I loved him.
Go ahead.
I loved him as an outlaw. He was great.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, when he was doing stuff with the Highwaymen, too. I mean, Chris is one of those artists that you don't think of off the top of the list, but he really deserves to be at the top of the list. He's so versatile, so talented in so many ways as an actor, a writer, a producer, everything.
Yeah.
He's a Renaissance man. I do want to talk to you about
very special
something that that has changed, and that is the concert business has evolved tremendously. When I first started out in the late 70s, I was a stage MC at the Hammond Civic Center doing, I think it was Celebration Flipside was our local production company. And I was MCing for like Judas Priest and UFO and The Hounds and Off-Broadway and Cheap Trick and all that. And it was very small based. I mean, everybody knew each other. Every area had their own little concert company, so to speak. Of course, Chicago had Jam. And then suddenly all the independents seemed to disappear when the conglomerates came out. You are still surviving. You are still doing the Bill Graham model, so to speak, and surviving as a concert promoter against the, you're a David against the Goliaths, I guess, is the fairest way to put it. How do you survive, and How has the change? I mean, the days of fans camping out at the local Carson's Ticketron and getting those first row seats because you spent 3 days in the rain outside waiting. No matter what you do, you can't get those seats anymore. You're still in the nosebleeds, even if you're in the first ones that purchase because of the fan club pulls and everything else. How has that affected you as a promoter? I mean, the changing in concerts for people that have never experienced the old days, the organic concert experience that we did. The younger kids today don't understand that. Talk a little bit about that change.
Well, the kids today can't possibly know about it, and it's their loss, but it's not on purpose, you know, or their fault, simply because we couldn't buy our tickets by our telephones or access our music by our telephones. Our telephones were on a wall at home.
Yeah.
Okay? So we didn't use this encyclopedia that fits in our hand the way that we're all using them today, not just kids, everybody. But back then, it was a ritual to go over to Flipside on Foster and wait all night long, no matter what the weather, for those tickets to go on sale 10 a.m. on Saturday morning. And they always went on sale at 10 a.m. on Saturday morning because, theoretically, everybody would have a chance to party the night before and go get in line the next day. But in some cases, you had to go and get in line the night before or even before that. I never did it more than one day, but I did it several times. And that was a part of the ritual of going to concerts, was getting the tickets first. Mm-hmm. You don't just get on your phone and hit a bunch of numbers with a credit card. We didn't have credit cards. We're lucky to have cash. So the whole ritual has changed as far as that goes. And as far as, you know, getting the tickets now, you know, I find, like, if somebody writes me a letter, and they do, because, I mean, I'm kind of easy to reach. I'm a lot easier to reach than promoters were that I was dealing with in the 60s and 70s as a ticket buyer. I've gotten letters from people saying, this is my favorite band. I don't want to miss them, and I want great seats. Can you help me do this? And as long as I can, you know, suss that out, and I know that this isn't somebody that's going to just go resell it, I'll hold them seats. I mean, I do it all the time. I mean, my goal is to make people not just happy but thrilled to go to a concert. Now, you're not going to have that kind of contact or touch with everybody that comes to your shows. I wish I could. But the fact is that the people in Chicago, where I have shows with Scotty Gelman there, we're doing Bachman Cummings and Gordon Lightfoot and Frankie Valli and Alan Parsons, and there's other shows, Air Supply. There's all kinds of weird shows that we're working on there for whenever things come back. And everybody that had tickets before COVID hit has hung on to them. I mean, it is remarkable. It's so supportive and feel so good. But the reason they're doing it is they already went through the trauma of buying tickets. They're happy with what they got, and they're going to see that show now like a badge of honor and a badge of courage because they've held on to them, and they're going to see their show. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure of that. But other than that, you know, how things change, I don't know if you know or not, but I actually sold into all of that and got out of it and lived to talk about it.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, I had a company called Evening Star that I started in the 70s. I did a joint venture with the aforementioned Jam Productions that I became friends with from living there. And we did shows together from the late 70s up until the early 2000s when I sold to a company called SFX.
Right.
And
them I'm familiar with.
Pardon me?
I said them I'm familiar with.
So, yeah, so I sold to them in 01, but little did I know that he was going to wrap all of those promoters up like me that he bought all around the country and wrap us into a tidy little package and sell us off to Clear Channel for a big profit. Had I known that that's what was going to happen, I might have not done it. But there was a lot of money involved, and I was happy to take it at the time. We were going into a new century. We had Y2K. We had it all going on then, and it was a different time just 20 years ago. And I went with it, and it seemed like a great idea at the time, being able to work with all those people you've either been in competition with or you know are legends themselves in their own neighborhood.
Because mm-hmm.
you had a guy in Boston, you had a guy in Philly, you had Florida, you had New York, you had San Francisco and L.A. and Chicago. You had people like 12, 13 major offices around the country. And when Clear Channel couldn't handle it and they just paid too much for this group of swarthy promoters, they divested themselves of it and it became Live Nation. So I was with SFX for a couple of years and then Clear Channel a couple of years. I signed on for one tour of duty with Live Nation, which ended in 2011. And for the last 10 years, I'm happy to say I'm back on my own and I made more money every year since leaving than I did when I was with them. That doesn't mean anything other than I worked really hard.
Right.
And because I had something at stake there. I mean, to come back after being on the other side like that was a very, very difficult thing to do. And now, you know, what can also be considered difficult is when, you know, they get shows that I've been promoting and percolating for decades. And it's my old office, by the way, people that I hired, who I still love, and they're great people, and they do a great job, but they get a lot of shows that I should be getting, and I got to kind of put my head down and work on the ones that I am getting and be happy that Jackson Browne and AC/DC and Eric Clapton and John Prine and Roger Waters and people like that haven't forgotten about me.
Right, right. Now, your company now is DZP Live, correct?
It's called Danny Zalisco Presents.
Okay.
But the website is dzplive.com where you can buy the book and tickets and whatever, see whatever other propaganda we're trying to spin as truth.
Okay. Now, in the making of this book, you cover a lot of time, a lot of concerts, a lot of artists. Did you have like a road diary of different things you did? Did you go back to your old four-drawer file cabinet and pull old contracts? I mean, you have so much information and memories, and the photos are just remarkable. One-of-a-kind photos from behind the scenes with the artists, posters, passes, everything. Where did you have all this stuff all these years?
Well, that's a great question. I have a house in Phoenix, and then right down the street, I got another house that was such a good deal when I got it a long time ago that I used it for storage and for an occasional guest would come and stay there when they needed a place to stay. But and that house has a guest house, so those places were loaded with stuff and not so much now. But I also have five storage spaces that contain my life, you know, from the business. One of them has all the contract files from all those shows from the mid to late 70s to all the way to 2001. There's another room that has nothing but tubs of T-shirts, thousands of concert shirts. Then there's posters and there's tickets and there's advertising and there's all kinds of really, really fun, cool, you know, stuff. Which I've actually started to market it and auction some of it off to try to lighten the load of what I have because God forbid anything ever happens and somebody else has to try to decipher this stuff. It's really, really fun and I'm really looking forward to sharing that with people as well as, you know, as these years unfold here, and we get back to doing concerts.
Right, which hopefully is very, very soon. I know there's a few things booked here in Chicago right now, and as I said, some of the festival things, local community fests that I'm working on are starting to happen again, and local theaters here. It's opening up in different parts of the country at different times. Do you have anything on the books as far as anywhere in the country? Are you strictly focusing on the Southwest?
We've got things, you know, like we've had a Gordon Lightfoot at the Copernicus Center in July. He's moved three or four times. I mean, the show has sold incredibly well. People want to see him. Frankie Valli, we've had to move a couple times. We had to move Bachman Cummings. So we're, you know, like I said, we're waiting for getting the word where people can sit down in a place together and enjoy a show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure, you know, masks will be in play. But I don't think that you're ever going to see shows happen with, you know, half of the people allowed in and half empty seats. I don't think shows are going to happen like that. They really haven't so far, except in some unusual, rare cases. I mean, whatever anybody wants to do, that's up to them. I'm kind of an old schooler when it comes to shows, and I think people got to be around each other, and they got to be able to react together and have fun together. And I think they're going to be doing that sooner than we think, with all the vaccines getting rolled out I think we're starting to see the other side of it. But you know, we got to wait until it's absolutely right, because who wants to go through this ever again?
Right, right. Well, I'm just glad that it's turning around, and God bless all you guys for doing what you're doing. And I didn't know you were working with Scotty Gelman. That's great to hear. You still got your connects here in Chicago. The Jerry and Arnie's, the Bill Graham's, those guys paved the way, blazed the trail. And I'm glad to see that the indie concert promoters are having a resurgence, just like vinyl is again. We're getting back to where it should be, where people who care about the music are actually producing the shows again.
Yeah, I think, I really think that for the most part, all the people today putting on shows are really concerned and care and want to put the best foot forward. But I got to tell you something, there's just no replacing somebody who puts their money where their mouth is and says, I believe in this group, I want to bring them to town, and I'm going to enjoy the rewards or I'm going to suffer the consequences of doing it. And that's what we do. And we try to be right. You know, every time out, we want to do the show on the right night of the week, in the right place that people want to. You know, there's that moment where you go, hey, did you hear so-and-so's coming? And you're waiting, you know, for where is it going to be? And when it lands in the right place, that feeling, that wave of relief going, that's going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's all about. You know, putting on shows, like, you know when things click, just like Paul and John nodded at each other when they wrote She Loves You and they heard it back for the first time, right?
Right.
You know, it's like, uh-oh, we've got it this time, guys.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Danny. Anything we haven't covered you'd like to let people know about your journey through sex, drugs, rock and roll, and coming out on the other side?
Well, I'll tell you what. The thing that I found by writing this book, and I'm hearing back from people, and, you know, you don't know how people are going to react to things. I mean, I'm not used to putting something out and getting people to react other than an announcement saying one of your favorite bands is coming to town. With this book, what I've heard so many times, and I love it, and it makes me feel so good, is they go, I really don't read books that often. I can't be bothered. I don't have time. I don't have the concentration anymore. And that this book, you've got to read. And this book is their favorite book. And I'm not just saying that to sell books. Well, of course I am. But I love repeating the fact that not only my friends, but strangers, the notes I've gotten from people saying, you know, you wrote about all my favorite groups. I was around during that time. I felt like I was there, especially now without being able to go out and enjoy ourselves at shows. At least we can think about this and look forward to, you know, better days. And that's what the book, you know, is there for, as well as I hope it leaves behind a little trail of little magic dust for people, where it's like, if you're thinking about taking a leap of faith and doing something that's outside of your comfort zone, I say do it and give it a try, because otherwise it's just going to bug you for the rest of your life. You're never going to know of whether or not you could have done something a little bit different or whatever that special thing that turns you on. And that's how I felt about music when I was able to embrace it and realize I couldn't play it, but I could still be involved with it. And here we are, and I've had a blast doing it. So I really appreciate you having me on today.
All right. Thank you so much. And again, when you're talking about reading books, 343 pages, over 600 photos, but the book is written as though you were telling the story. There's a lot of Q&A style in here. There's little vignettes of different shows, different artists, different experiences. So it's a super easy read. It's one of those books you can read for 15, 20 minutes, put down, come right back, and you haven't lost anything. The style and the layout is magnificent. It's available in a beautiful paperback version as well as on Kindle. And you can find it at Danny's site. And again, that's dzplive.com is the website. Danny Zalesko Presents is the company. And Danny, best wishes in getting things back on the road. I hope I'll see you at a Chicago show sometime.
I can't wait. Make sure we do, okay?
All right. Thank you so much.
All right, my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Stick around. We've got Kathy Valentine from the Go-Go's coming up on the second half. If you missed it, this interview is actually going to be from last week when she was on, but I know a lot of folks missed it, and we're going to repeat it because, hey, it's Kathy Valentine, for goodness sake, and who doesn't love the Go-Go's? But first, we're going to play a song because this one always has impact with anyone that's in the concert business and the rock and roll business because, as we know, even though the years pass, the decades pass, the shows come and go, in the long run, we're all Chuck's children, and one of the things that we know is rock and roll will never forget. And if you got a book like All Excess, you'll never forget as well because there's some great pictures and stories. So here's Bob Seger, and then we're going to go right on into my interview with Kathy Valentine of the Go-Go's. Stay with us, and thank you for supporting National Public Radio and Lakeshore Public Radio at 89.1 FM on the dial. So y'all
shake them down, but now you stop and think about your dignity. So now sweep it.